Okay, we're back in part two of our presentation for Rabbeim and educators on compulsive sexual behavior. Here we go. We mentioned last time that this event was sponsored by Shlavim, Shlavim. They have a website, shlavim.org. Check it out. That's so important to know because if you have a Talmud or a friend that needs help and you're not even sure what the problem is, you're not even sure who can help this person or what to do, you call Shlavim and they'll take it from there. Okay, so we're up to slide number 12 in the slideshow presentation. If you don't have it, don't panic. You'll probably be able to understand just fine without the presentation. So in slide number 12, we have a picture of a wooden box. It looks like a wooden box with a globe inside. And I wrote in big red capital bold letters, not everyone is in one box. And what I mean to say is that every mental health issue, whether it's depression, it's anxiety, it's a psychotic disorder like schizophrenia, any single problem like this comes in a spectrum. And that means you'll have people with the same problem, but some people will have it more severe and some people will have it less severe. The same is true with addiction. When you talk about addiction, some people are very, very severely addicted, and other people are very mildly addicted, and other people are in the middle. And for one guy, just to use some concrete examples, one guy is looking at pornography and he's having a difficult time, and it's hard for him to stop. He goes onto the GuardiRise website. He makes himself some sort of a anonymous profile. He starts reading their articles and maybe doing their 90-day chart and the different tools that they have. And you know what happens? That guy's matzliach. He gets better. And that's great. But that doesn't mean that what happened to him is going to work for everybody else. Not only because everybody is different in their personality and in their needs, but also because there are different levels of addiction. So that guy had a mild problem. He used a mild intervention and he got better. And that's amazing. But you'll have a different guy that he did all the tools in GuardiRise and he went to the 12-step program and he went to four therapists and it didn't help. Because his problem is so severe, he needs an inpatient, intensive 90-day program. I'm just giving a very extreme example. Okay, so you have a guy who has a very severe issue. And he needs a severe intervention. Okay? It's not black and white like I'm saying either. Sometimes you have a very severe problem, and miraculously, you can use a moderate or more mild type of tool, and it might actually help. Those things do happen. That's backed up by professional research. That could happen. But the point is, I would like people listening to this to know that addiction comes in three levels. The three levels are mild, moderate, and severe. Okay? So that is very, very important to know when you're talking about a certain bacher or a certain avreich, a person with a problem. You're trying to understand, according to the story that you hear, does this guy have a mild problem, a moderate problem, or a severe problem? Okay? Okay, now how do you know, like, how do professionals decide what's mild, moderate, or severe? So one way is that it's suggested that if a person has two or three symptoms, that might be something which is mild. If the therapist can hear from the person's story, he's got four or five symptoms, perhaps. That's more severe, obviously. That's more serious. And then if he has six or more symptoms of the different ways that professionals describe addiction, that might be a severe addictive disorder on the level of severe, the third level. Okay? So you have mild, moderate, and severe. The more symptoms that a person has, perhaps that would suggest that he has a more serious problem. If severity changes across time, which means that he started, let's use the example of alcohol for a minute. He started with one beer a day, and now he's up to a case a day. Probably that's becoming more severe. The person is doing the act in more frequency or in a bigger dose. Okay, so this person used to look at lightweight, inappropriate pictures, and now he's looking at very intense types of things in the internet. Or he used to act out once a month. Now he's acting out with people on the street three or four times a day, okay, or a week. Obviously, that would reflect a much more serious problem. Okay. One of the ways that I like to pay attention when I hear a client's story, one of the ways that I like to figure out if it's mild, moderate, or severe is I want to hear, is this person going out of their way to pursue the behavior that they're trying to stop? Or maybe they just do this when it's available to them, but when it's not available to them, they don't bother to go out of their way to go after that. For me, I consider that a very important indicator of what type of problem we're dealing with. And I'll give a concrete example that's very common in yeshiva. You have a yeshiva bachar that bein hazmanim, he goes home, and of course there's no structure, bein hazmanim. He's got all this time in his hands, his parents are working, all these computers are around, and he finds himself looking at pornography, and he just really has a terrible, very, very bad bein hazmanim. But when he comes back to the zman, the question is like this. He comes back to yeshiva. Does he go now and try to plan how he's going to look at that stuff here? Or does he forget about it again until next bein hazmanim, where unfortunately he goes and falls again? Obviously, he could find access to pornography here in Yerushalayim. It's not that hard, unfortunately. So is he going to, you know, try to find opportunities or create opportunities? I've met people that they've been so desperate, they've broken into people's houses and stolen computers in order to do their addiction. In a less serious or dramatic way, actually, but indicator of something that is a little bit more serious. You have some people that they will... sorry, I got confused for a second. You have some people that they will go to an internet cafe, okay? They're in yeshiva, but they'll go out of their way. They'll find the right cafe. They'll find a way to spend money to go to a place and look at this bad stuff. Or maybe they'll bring devices with them from America. Or maybe they'll figure out a way to break into the yeshiva computer lab. Or maybe they'll look at it. They'll look at the stuff on their roommate's phone, okay? Whatever it is, they're going out of their way and pursuing this, in order to do it. Okay, so you have one guy that he doesn't pursue it. When it's in his face, he does it. When it's not in his face, he doesn't do it. You have the other guy, he goes out of his way to look for it. Okay, another extreme way that people pursue this sometimes is you have a bachur that he meets a girl and they act out together. That's one case. You know, he met her somewhere and they did what they did. But you have a different guy that every night he's cruising. That's like a term that they use in this field. He's cruising, he's walking up and down parks, he's walking down streets every night looking for this. He's going out of his way looking for it. It's not just something that was an opportunity that came his way, but he's going out of his way, making an effort to look for this. Okay, let's continue. So we're up to slide number 13. This again is going back to which criteria are not classified as an addiction by itself if you don't have any other signs. In other words, we're going to say a list now of a few things that if you just see these things and there's no other signs or symptoms at all, that doesn't mean that he has an addiction. These things by themselves don't necessarily mean that a person has an addiction. It could be he has a moral problem. Could be he's got a psychological problem. He's got a social problem. But to say he has an addiction, we wouldn't go so far. So number one, if you see a person doing immoral activity, okay, he does eshes ish, well, that's terrible. But that's not necessarily indicating that he has an addiction. If he does eshes ish every day of the week, it also doesn't necessarily indicate he has an addiction. It could indicate he's a rasha. It could indicate he has to do tshuva. It could indicate he's a bal taiva. But it doesn't necessarily mean that he has an addiction. Does he have a loss of control? Did he ever try to stop? Are there any consequences? Does he even care about what he's doing? So again, all these things, they always have a context to them. So if you just see a guy doing immoral activity, it doesn't mean that he has an addiction. Number two, if he does a culturally unacceptable or illegal activity. Okay, so for example, if a person is with a zayna, okay, and let's say that being with a zayna is illegal, which actually it's not so simple in the state of Israel. Unfortunately, in certain cases, it's permitted according to law. Isn't that strange? But anyways, the fact that a person does something that's illegal, and you say, whoa, if he does something illegal, it must mean he's addicted. So that's not true. Okay, number three, if a person has a fetish. Now, fetish, we're going to talk about what that means, but basically, in two sentences, a person's taiva could be expressed in very, very interesting ways that maybe not everyone else expresses in that way. For example, let's say a person is very turned on and aroused by animals, okay? So that's certainly not a common thing, but that doesn't mean he has an addiction. It means he has a fetish, which we're going to talk about that later on, but it doesn't mean he has an addiction, and right now we're talking about an addiction. Okay, another thing on our list, if a person has same-sex attraction, so it's a boy who's attracted sexually by boys, he's aroused by other boys, or a girl that's aroused by girls, maybe he even acts out with another boy, or this girl acts out with another girl, that might be a problem, but that doesn't mean they have an addiction. Okay, we'll get to this later on in more depth. Okay, if a person watches pornography for 6 hours in a row and he has tremendous guilt and shame, that also doesn't mean he has an addiction. It means he did an avera, he has charata. It can mean a lot of things, but it doesn't mean he has an addiction, etc. Okay, so you got the idea. Okay, so now we're getting to one of the more interesting parts of the talk. So we're going to talk about paraphilia, and that's on slide number 14. Okay, so paraphilia is a sexual type of problem, but it's not an addiction problem, but it could overlap with addiction, and we're going to talk about this. So if what I'm saying sounds like Chinese, don't worry, have patience, and we will get to all this in great detail. Okay, so basically, in the mind, we'll say this really, really brief. In the mind, we have, let's call it an arousal template. And that's basically, for each person, there is some tfus, there's some template, which for him, it is written there in his brain, this is what will arouse him sexually. Okay, so one person is very aroused by women, okay, right? Most people are aroused by women. So that's in their arousal template, that when they see a woman, maybe a certain type of woman or a certain aged woman, maybe they're dressed a certain way, they're aroused, okay? And that's how their Yetzer works, right? But sometimes that arousal template, that part of the brain, it gets linked or associated or hooked up with objects or with people of the same gender or with animals or with certain behaviors. And all of a sudden, for this person to become aroused, he now has to have this behavior happen or see that animal. And every time he sees that animal, he's going to be sexually aroused. Everyone's going to the zoo, it's Chol HaMoed, and he sees this animal and he's getting aroused. No one else gets aroused, but he does because he has a paraphilia for this thing. Okay? So it's basically, just try to understand in a very simple way, it's when a person's taiva is linked or happens through a certain thing. Okay, so now we're going to give some of the famous names, names of some of the famous types of paraphilias. Bachram have these things, I promise you they have them. If you think that Bachram and Avreichim are ashamed to talk about looking at pornography or other issues, they're even more ashamed to talk about this because not only are they falling into their taiva, but they even have an interesting taiva, a unique taiva, which is very shameful. Okay, so you have to make a lot of room when talking to Bachram and Avreichim about these issues, to make sure not to shame them, not to be surprised if you hear something that you've never heard before, and to you this sounds disgusting, it sounds crazy, you have to be really, really careful, because if you show them that that you think that they're crazy, you think that they're a freak, you think that it's disgusting, they're not going to want to talk again, they're not going to want to get help. As it is, I think this is one of the things that I forgot to put in the presentation, but it's so important. One of the first things you need to do bichlal when you talk with Bachram, Avreichim, or a client about these topics is to break the chain, to make a compassionate opportunity and relationship for for them to be able to approach you and talk about any sort of thing that they've done and that's on their mind and that they're thinking of doing, that they're in the middle of doing, because otherwise there's no way you can even make that relationship and use it to help this person heal. Okay, so now that we've said that, one of the famous types of paraphilias is called voyeurism. And voyeurism is when a person is very aroused by watching other people being together sexually or watching another person getting undressed or taking a shower. Okay, I've had a few bachurim that they are voyeurs. They have voyeurism. And not only do they have voyeurism, in other words, not only was their taiva connected to this and they were aroused by that, but it was even more than that. They did this compulsively. They did this addictively. I remember one guy who would literally walk all around one of the neighborhoods in Yerushalayim for hours a day, hoping and peeking into different people's windows, house by house, street by street, hopefully, finding an opportunity where he can watch something, whether it's two people being together, whether it's somebody getting undressed, and that was what he did. But forget the compulsive part. Now we're talking about, even if it's not compulsive, just that is something that is arousing to him, very, very much so. And sometimes it's actually even necessary for this person to see. And if he doesn't see it, he might not even be able to get aroused without it. Okay, so that's voyeurism. Exhibitionism is a fascinating one. That's where a person exposes himself to other people. In other words, he'll drop his pants, he'll show his body parts to other people. Maybe he'll do it in a way that they could see it. Maybe he'll do it in a way that they could almost see it. But either way, that is what is arousing to him. He needs to do this to be aroused. And when he does this, he gets very, very aroused. Okay? I remember even meeting a Rebbe, that the Rebbe had this issue. And he would actually do this with women walking by the window where he lived. Okay, frauderism. I'm thinking of all the people I met that had frauderism. Frauderism is where you rub up to other people. In other words, it's kind of like planned that a person will rub their body against another person and they'll be aroused by that rubbing. Okay, so this is especially easy to do with these people that I've met that they take the light rail train here in Yerushalayim or very packed buses or it's a very packed store. And I don't want to get into too many details, but they kind of plan to rub themselves here and there for a moment against women, or maybe it's men if that's what they're attracted to. And that's what they do. Okay, masochism is the next one. And that's when a person gets beaten by somebody else, and that is sexually arousing to them. And that's actually a very common one, as crazy as that sounds. And for the sake of curiosity, I'll tell you about asphyxophilia. I've never met a person with this, but I have no doubt it exists. That's where a person is aroused by being choked by somebody else. And obviously that's dangerous because when you choke other people, that could be dangerous because they could get hypoxia and they could die, right? Okay, sadism is when a person beats somebody else, and when he beats them, he is aroused. In other words, masochism is when they hit him, and sadism is when he is aroused by him hitting them. Okay, let's move on. Pedophilic disorder, or pedophilia, that's a very famous one because that's a person who's attracted to young children, right? When you talk about a pedophile is a person who has pedophilia, and it's a person who is attracted to children. Most people, in their arousal template, they're not attracted to children, but this guy is. Okay, again, that doesn't mean he has an addiction. It can obviously be a very serious problem for the children in that neighborhood that there's a person who is attracted to children. But it doesn't mean that he's doing this because of addiction, and it doesn't mean that the treatment that you're going to want to give him has anything to do with addiction. If he does this addictively, then he may also have pedophilia and may also have an addiction. Okay, moving along. Fetishism. This is so, so, so common. And that's when a person links their taiva to either parts of the body which are not necessarily sexual parts. In other words, Let's say a person is very attracted to somebody's feet, and he's busy walking around in the summer looking at all the different people's feet outside. Okay, now the feet, Chazal tell us in the Gemara, there are so many different things that are erva. Kol be'isha erva, se'er be'isha erva. I don't think it says anywhere that the feet of a woman is erva. Although yesh ma'adun, we could talk about that, but it's not the point of our presentation. But the point is, it's not a common place where a person is aroused, and yet this person, in order to be aroused, is looking at the feet. Or maybe he's looking at an object. He's looking at somebody's shoes. He's looking at a bow in the person's hair. He's looking at brown shoes, or he's looking at high heels. He's looking at the bow in the girl's hair or a necklace. And for him, this makes him aroused. And that's very important to understand, because imagine a bachur who, imagine a bachur who is very highly aroused. Well, we'll get that. You know what? I'm going to put a pause on that. We'll get to that in a minute, because I think there's a whole slide about that. Okay, transvestism is when a person is aroused by putting on clothing of the other gender. Okay, because if he's wearing his own clothing and it's his own gender, so that doesn't really happen. But, right, it's a man that puts on woman's clothing, a woman that puts on man's clothing. Okay, it's also called autogynephilia. Okay, you have other ones. Telephone scatagoglia. That's when a person calls up people on the phone and says obscene sexual things to them, and that arouses him. Okay, obviously it traumatizes the other person. Zoophilia is animals, as we mentioned. Coprophilia. Okay, I've had quite a few bachurim with coprophilia, so don't think it doesn't happen. That's when a person he goes to the bathroom and then he is aroused. Or arouses himself, I'm not going to get into details, but he uses the feces that he makes to arouse himself. And that is very sexually arousing. That's coprophilia. And necrophilia is finally, thank God I've never had a bachur with necrophilia, and I should never have one. That's when a person is aroused by dead bodies. And just in case you ever follow the news and you hear some sort of a story where a woman or a child is kidnapped and they are killed, and it seems like they did something to them sexually, so it could be that they had necrophilia. In other words, they're aroused by a dead body, so they looked for a person to turn into a dead body and then do whatever they do. Okay? So thank God we got that done. So paraphilic disorders, all these things we just spoke about, all these paraphilias are closely related to addiction. And I would say that they're like cousins who are very close to each other. They're good friends, they see each other at family simchas. They stay in touch. So they're not the same, but they often coincide together, as we will soon see. Okay, so we're moving on to slide 15, and now we're going to understand why I traumatized all of you with all these interesting things. And the answer is like this. Because one of the way that addiction works is that addiction works through being triggered. In other words, the mind has certain associations which, when it sees certain things, it kicks off his addiction. It sends him an urge to act out or to drink. So, to give a simple example, okay, a person who used to smoke a lot of marijuana, and he's addicted to marijuana, and he used to be into that culture, and he used to have Bob Marley posters all over. So, if he sees now a picture of Bob Marley, that might give him an urge to smoke marijuana. In other words, a minute before this, he wasn't thinking about marijuana, he didn't feel like smoking it, but he saw a picture on an album cover in a CD store of Bob Marley, and before you know it, oh my gosh, he's got this urge to smoke marijuana. Because his mind made an association between marijuana and his addiction and this picture of this guy, Bob Marley. So the same thing happens too when you talk about sexual addiction. You can have a person who they have a paraphilia, which we said is not an addiction, right? A paraphilia is just an attraction to something. So let's say he's attracted to women's shoes or boots, okay? He's attracted to boots. When he sees a boot, he gets very aroused. He doesn't necessarily get aroused addictively, but he gets very aroused. It's very arousing to him to see a person wearing boots. And it's the winter in Yerushalayim, and of course, people put on their boots. And not only that, but he has an addiction. So not only is he aroused by this and he gets a geschmack out of that, but it kicks off his addiction. He's got an urge now to do this addictively. To addictively, for example, walk up and down the streets in Geula looking at all the people wearing these boots, or maybe taking pictures of them with his phone and saving those pictures so he can look at them later on. Or maybe he even buys these boots, he buys women's boots and puts them on in his dira when no one's looking, and that's arousing to him. And he'll do all sorts of things, and all of these things happened. His addiction gets kicked off or ignited because he saw the boots, okay? So here's this innocent bachar. He's at a Shabbos meal, and he's at the Rashiva's house, and the Rashiva's wife is wearing boots. The bachar didn't do anything wrong. He's sitting at the Shabbos meal, he sees the boots, and before you know it, he's very, very aroused. His addiction is kicked off, and when he leaves that meal, for all we know, he might go back to his addiction, whatever it was that he was doing. He's going to go back and do that now because of the arousal that he got from the object, which is linked to his arousal template. Okay, it's a fascinating idea. On slide 15 on the bottom, I gave a very, very common example, which is a sad example, but it happens in our yeshivas. If you have a person with same-sex attraction, in other words, a bachar who's attracted to men, which has nothing to do with addiction, right? But not only that, but he's also addicted to acting out. So now he's addicted to acting out because he has an addiction in this area. And you know what he's attracted to? Men. And guess which men he sees when he's in yeshiva? He sees the men in yeshiva, right? He sees the boys in his dira. He sees the boys in his shir, the boys in the base medrash, the boys in the lunchroom. That guy might end up coming to me and telling me that he's acting out with bachrim in the yeshiva, okay? It's a good kasha if you're going to ask, okay, he's attracted to them, but are they attracted to him? It's a good question. But the point is that this guy now is attracted all day and has urges all day to act out with people in his own yeshiva because his arousal template is connected to something that he sees all the time in his environment. Okay, he's a good bachar. He's in yeshiva. He never leaves the Kaisleya Beis Medrash. He's a masmid. But there's boys in the Beis Medrash, okay? And those types of cases become a bit complicated. Obviously, when you talk about treatment, one of the parts of treatment is going to be, if it's possible, which it's not always possible, to help defuse a person's paraphilia, which it is somewhat possible sometimes. These things are very deeply entrenched in the brain, so it's not that simple. But even if you can't defuse a person's paraphilia, you could help them recover from addiction, so much so that they get a bit bored from their paraphilia, and it doesn't necessarily kick them off like it used to. Okay, moving right along. On slide number 16, so we have differential diagnosis. In other words, there are some things that they look like problem A, but they're really problem B. Okay? So, for example, if a bachar is obsessing about sexual thoughts all the time, okay? So somebody might say, oh, obsession. This guy must have OCD, right? That's an obsessive problem. And they might even send him to a professional that thinks it's OCD. And that professional, understandably, is going to try to use a treatment that was designed for OCD. But if it isn't OCD, it's not going to work. Okay? Let me read the words of the slide just because it explains a little bit better what I'm trying to say. Obsessions and compulsions with such sexual content can occur in OCD. In other words, it is shayach that you can have a guy with OCD about sexual things. However is a big word. However, the content of those obsessions consisted most often not of fantasies, but of fears of acting out on sexual impulses or fears of being a pervert. When you talk about OCD, OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder is about anxiety. It's about fear. It's classified actually as an anxiety disorder. It's something that a person is worried about happening. So it could be that you have a bachar who is thinking all day about acting out with another bachar in his dira. But he's not enjoying it when he's thinking that way. He's afraid that it will happen. He's obsessing about this fantasy and about how this might happen, God forbid, and it will be so embarrassing. So that sounds more like OCD than like a sexual addiction, okay? Because it's about fear. The feature, the main characteristic is about fear. It's about not fantasy, but about fear or about anxiety, okay? So you have things like that sometimes that it sounds like an addiction, but it's something else, or it sounds like something else and it's an addiction. And obviously a professional, his job is to be able to understand what is what and what is the ensuing treatment. I'm going to tell a sad story. It's a story that bothers me. I mean, it really makes me angry. There's a big OCD specialist in Yerushalayim. Of course, such a big specialist, he takes 700-800 shekel an hour. And this specialist sees everything as OCD, which is concerning, obviously. And I had a wonderful, wonderful bacher who came to me. And he told me that he was coming from seeing this guy. Okay, what was the problem? This guy, this bacher, would go to zaynas, he would go to prostitutes. He would spend a lot of money doing this. It's a whole complicated story how he got money to do this, but that's what he did. And somebody said, you know, you're obsessing about zaynas all day, and you're compulsively going to them. It must be you have OCD. Go to the expert on OCD. So he went to the expert on OCD. And the expert on OCD said, I have a treatment for OCD that will help you because you have OCD. And in OCD treatment, we do exposure therapy. In other words, if you have OCD about dirt and you are afraid that you will get sick because you're going to touch germs, you're going to touch dirt. So your refuah is we're going to dafka expose you to dirt. We're going to make you touch the toilet seat. We're going to make you touch dirt. And we're going to do that enough times until you get used to that and you calm down. Okay? That's in a nutshell what exposure therapy is. So the brilliant professor said, I'm going to do that with you too. I'm going to have you call up zaynas and go to the hotel with them and go up to the room with them and then walk out. That's what you're going to do. You're going to expose yourself to this and then not do it. Guess what happened? Ein tzarach leimar, what happened, okay? Obviously, this guy ended up acting out because he didn't have OCD. He had an addiction. And with addiction, exposure does the exact opposite. It makes you want to do it more. The guy didn't gain anything except a few avers. Okay. Slide number 18. No, 17. Slide 17. So here's a list of helpful questions, and I'm going to read each one of them in case you don't have the slides. If you need the slides, send me an email, avitenenbaum9@gmail.com. But just in case somehow you can't get that email to you, I'm going to read you the questions. Okay, so imagine a bacher comes to you and you're able to sit with him and ask him some more questions and get some more information. I wrote here about 20 questions, 25 questions that will give a heck if it will give a better idea of what's happening. So you can ask him, what exactly do you struggle with? Okay, what exactly do you struggle with is an open-ended question. And an open-ended question gives him an opportunity to say anything on his mind. You want to always ask open-ended questions because instead of yes or no questions, open-ended questions will allow the person you're interviewing to tell you anything, right? Do you act out with other people in our yeshiva? Yes. No. Well, it gives you a little bit of information, but not much. But if you say, what exactly do you struggle with? So you've used an open-ended question and you might get all sorts of interesting information. Obviously, later on, you could go and be more specific. Do you act out with people? Do you act out by looking at pornography or things in the internet? Do you act out with objects, right? We spoke about paraphilia and objects. What exactly is it that you do? Can you describe more so that I understand better? If I would see a video of what you do, and I would see this like security camera, you know, showing from the beginning to the end, what would I see? Or what type of things do you watch when you look at pornography? That could be a very revealing question because he could say he watches something that's very light. He could say he watches something that's very intense and concerning, and anything in between. How often does this occur? What makes it worse for you? What makes it better? What are the conditions that, when you have those conditions, you don't even think of doing this? Have you ever tried to stop before? How are the ways that you've tried to stop? How long has this problem been going for you? When did this problem start? When did it get worse? If it got worse. Are there certain thoughts, emotions, or physical feelings that precede and encourage you to do this? Are there certain things that you see or think about that urge you and prompt you to go ahead with these behaviors? How long have you had this problem? Did the problem get worse over the years? What is the longest time that you've been free from doing this? When exactly is the last time that you did this? Do you have a theory about why exactly you do this? And that's a very interesting question, by the way. If you were a scientist or a researcher and you were studying this case, in other words, your own case, could you propose a theory as to why you think you act out? That's a very revealing question, because one bacher will say, you know, Rebbe, I think I act out because of stress. Another guy will say, I don't know why I act out. And, you know, and it will take you in different directions, that question. And it's a fascinating question. Are there things in your environment or in your possession that make this harder for you or that give you access to do what you do? In other words, sometimes you have a bacher that he looks at pornography. In the whole story, all has to do with the fact that this guy's got a smartphone with Wi-Fi and he hops Wi-Fi off of the neighbor and it's not locked. And if you just got rid of that phone, the whole problem is solved. Obviously, that's a very wonderful case. How have I should get such a case? You meet the guy one time, suggested he gets rid of his phone, he gets rid of it, v'shalom al Yisrael. Okay? Or maybe he's a guy that he has a mild problem or a moderate problem, so much so that when he has access to this thing, easy access to pornography, he'll look at it. But when he doesn't, then he won't look at it. And so the whole treatment will be helping him be motivated to want to get rid of that phone. But once he gets rid of the phone, he's not going to go to town to look at pornography. Okay, so it's a very important question. Are there things in your environment or things in your possession that make this harder for you or give you access to do what you do? What triggers you? Which people or situations or emotions or opportunities or feelings trigger you to act out? Do you have physiological urges? Are they painful? What's it like? Do you suddenly feel sometimes like you need to act out? How do your urges work for you? Here's another really open, general question. How does your addiction work for you? Describe, how does it work? Like, what's the process from A to Z? It starts with this, it ends with this. Are there certain rituals that you do along the way? You know, in other words, sometimes when a person acts out, they do it in a certain place. They do it at a certain time, with a certain person, in a certain way. And there's all these rituals involved. Okay. Moving along. Slide number 18. Do you have other struggles as well, like anxiety or depression? Were you ever abused in any way or traumatized? Are things okay at home? Do you have any friends? Do you have any close friends that you share things with? Have you ever shared this problem with anybody? What resources do you have to get better? Do you have the willingness to get better? Do you have the money to get better? Etc., etc., etc. Okay, now that the Rebbe has asked all these questions in an empathic way to make sure we don't shame the bacher, now you can review in your mind what you've heard, and you can ask yourself the following questions. Do you think that this is a problem that you or the yeshiva has the tools to solve? Is the problem caused by a lack of information, which by giving over this information, the problem will be solved? And if so, who is qualified to give that information? In other words, sometimes the problem is so mild that you just need to give over some information, whether it's Musar, Taichacha, okay? Some sort of zets that you give to the guy or you learn something with him. And before you know it, that itself has fixed the problem. Are we talking about that or are we talking about something that you need a professional? Is the problem one that may suggest a mental health professional's outlook and assistance? Do you see a problem that can be easily solvable by treating his environment or his access to the internet, etc.? In other words, sometimes a person's problem is just in his environment. If you can get him into a better environment or take the problem out of his environment, the problem is solved. Do you see problems that interact with one another or that need attention? Okay. So for example, let's say the Bachar has tremendous anxiety about everything. Okay, and that's a serious problem. He's anxious all the time. He's in tremendous psychological pain. And he also looks at pornography. So obviously, we should imagine that his anxiety interacts with pornography. I'm willing to bet you, without even meeting this guy, probably he even looks at pornography as a way to relieve his anxiety. Okay, not always, but the point is all these problems fit together. Maybe this guy has Shalom Bayis problems at home. And it's so sad and it's so terrible that the way he kind of runs away from it is into a fantasy world. So he acts out, he's Maitzizera Lavatala, imagining different women that he saw that day in Geula. And that's his way of escaping from the problem in his face at hand that's causing him pain. Okay? So on the one hand, we want to help him with his addiction. But on the other hand, we also probably need to treat the other issue at hand, whether it's the Shalom Bayis or the anxiety or the depression, etc., etc. So after you've asked all these questions to the Bachar and you've thought about this, you should probably have some sort of a direction of what the Bachar needs. Okay, good. I see here that we put this in. Slide number 19. Particularly with from people, despair, D-E-S-P-A-I-R, despair, is a feature that, if it's not worked through, can become a barrier to treatment. Okay? Baruch Hashem, I've learned a little bit in my life, especially things of Hashkafa, Mosar Chassidus, and it's so beneficial to the work that I do with people, because when you get a frum bachar or a Rebbe, kol shekein if it's a Talmud Chacham, they walk into treatment with 53 terutzim about why they can never get better, why Hashem is not going to help them. I'm going to give some common examples. The Zayar says, there's no way to do tshuva. I've done this so many times, there's no way that Hashem will help me anymore, right? Because it says, echeta v'ashuv, it says in the Gemara, Hashem doesn't help him. I don't really think it's possible to stop. I've tried this for years. Okay? If you learn these sugyas, and you know how to answer them in that level, in that Torah level, it's so helpful to treatment. Okay, so I'm not a Rebbe, I'm not a Reshiva, but just if the guy brings up the Zayar and you know three terutzim to that Zayar, it can do wonders. But the point is that when these people come to treatment, and we're talking about from people, Talmidei Chachamim, Yarei Shamayim, they're people that they care about Hashem, they care about mitzvahs, some more, some less, but they care, they're learned, they may have learned scary things about the things that they're doing. You've got to address despair. Whether you do it in a direct way, by answering them through Torah, Terutzim, to their Torah question, or whether you do it, you're not such a Goy Salamdin, you didn't learn these things so much, but you know how to do it in an empathic way and saying, listen, I don't know the answer to the Zayar, but I've helped a few people in the past, and B'siyata D'Shmaya, let's give it a try, maybe I can help you too. Okay, moving on to slide number 20, the onion model. Okay, I didn't have a name for this, so that's the name I gave. An onion has many, many layers. You've got outer layers, you've got inner layers. So when you're talking about this bachar or this avreich with the problem, what are the outer layers that need peeling or attention first? If I deal with the outer layers first, will that solve other inner layers or problems? Right? Sometimes you get two birds with one stone. Right? One time I said that expression to someone in the 12-step group, and they said back to me, why would you kill birds? So it's a good question, but the point is, sometimes if you take care of problem A, it helps problem A and problem B, because he was doing B because of A, right? If this guy, if the main dominant feature in his story is that he's so depressed and he has low self-esteem and he feels that nobody likes him, and you feel, it sounds to you like he goes and does all sorts of things and is addicted to who knows what because of this problem, so probably this is a very important place to start. Obviously, just fixing low self-esteem alone isn't going to solve addiction. Addiction is a standalone problem, usually, which is a disorder in the brain. I see that we're going to get to that in the next slide. But the point is, What could I deal with first that's going to help me get to the next place with this guy? What resources are available to help the Talmud? Who can connect the Bachar or the Avrich to those resources? Okay, another thing that I talk about is there's the environment, in other words, the sviva, the surrounding of the Bachar, and you also have the intrapsychic features. In other words, you have addiction itself, which is its own mental health issue. You have other mental health issues that might interact and exacerbate and make worse the addiction, like anxiety, depression. And then you have the environment. The fact that his laptop has no filter on it, or the fact that he, you know, keeps going to town and his dira is right near town, and you know, and he's going to different internet cafes. So obviously, you've got all these different components. You've got the intrapsychic components, the components of the problem that are in the guy's mind. You've got the components that are external, the ones that are in his environment. And you're trying to treat both of these issues. You're trying to also treat the environment and make that better for him to be matzliach. You're trying to also treat the intrapsychic things that are going on, whether it's depression or whether it's addiction. Okay? When you have all of those down and you try to address all these issues, usually you're matzliach. At the end of the day, obviously, you can't block a guy from every computer in the world and every bad site in the world. There's always ways to get around filters if you're savvy enough. There's always internet cafes out there. There's always women and men to act out with. There's always alcohol in the world, and there's always ways to gamble. So ultimately, obviously, you can't completely protect a bachur 1,000% from this world, okay? He was born in this generation to deal with this world, and somehow, by hook or by crook, it should work out. But obviously, you can only treat the environment up to a certain extent. But I always say that when you treat it as best as you can, you've helped that bachur that much more. So if he has 100% of a problem, and let's say that 17% of the 100% of the problem is the environment, and now you've treated his environment and you've made it much easier, now you've given the guy an 83% problem to deal with. And that's an easier problem to deal with. And if it's 83% of a problem to deal with, and now you help him work through his issues of self-esteem and shame, okay, now you've got it down to 70%. Okay, 70% is a lot easier to work with than 100%. Okay, and so forth and so forth. Okay, so slide 21 is saying that addiction is chronic. By the way, I give this lecture to professionals, and if you are a professional listening to this, I could send you the professional lecture, and there you'll see all the different sources for all of this. So just for example, how do we know that addiction is chronic? So you can look up in the American Society of Addiction Medicine. So they and other people talk about this as well. But this we're just trying to keep it pretty simple here. Okay, so let's just assume addiction is chronic. Chronic means that it's something which won't completely go away with treatment. Even if you treat it, thank God you've treated it. It's not right now acting up, but it still requires ongoing maintenance or some sort of effort to keep up the status quo. For example, let's say a person has diabetes. Diabetes never will go away, but it can be managed. Okay, so what this means is a person may have an addiction their whole life, but it may not be a problem to have an addiction his whole life. He might need to do a few simple things, whether it's per week or per day or per month, that when he does those things and he keeps himself in the right place, he keeps the status quo and he doesn't go back to his addiction. But you still have to keep an eye out. You still have to manage it. You have to do those things, okay? When you talk about a moderate and severe level addiction, it's a chronic problem. Baruch Hashem, the guy can get treatment, he can get better, but he might need to manage this later on to make sure he doesn't go back and relapse, okay? When you talk about a mild addiction, the lowest level, quite often you've treated the problem will not go back, okay? He was very entangled. You could tell there's some chronicity in the brain. In other words, he does have a sort of strong relationship more than other people to this behavior, but he needs very minimal effort, if almost any, to maintain his situation. Yet, 25 years later, if he gets divorced and loses all of his kids in a fire, Leilenu, and he's in a very bad situation, you can bet your bottom dollar the first thing he'll think of is running back to his addiction because it was there in the brain. So it has some chronicity, but it doesn't really need to be managed. But in most cases, an addiction does need to be managed. Some people manage their addiction by going to a 12-step group. Other people manage their addiction by just, you know, putting themselves in the right place, getting the right job, trying to keep themselves happy, learning some skills to manage their feelings that used to trigger them into acting out, whether it was managing their anxiety, managing depression, whatever it was, and keeping on top of that. Okay, let's take a break for a second.